Community. All members of the board having anything to bring before the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Morning, counsel.
Morning, your honors. May it please the court. I am Jim Taylor, counsel to the University of Delaware and Dr. Melvin Schiavelli. I rise to introduce my colleague, Mr. James Boudreau of the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. Mr. Boudreau has been admitted to this court pro hac vice, and with the court's permission, will be presenting oral argument on behalf of our clients this morning.
Good morning, Mr.
Boudreau.
Welcome.
I'm the appellee.
I know that it's traditional in Delaware when the court looks at you, you stand.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ronald Gellert from the law firm of Eckert, Seaman, Sharon, Malott. It is my pleasure to introduce to you today William Ewing, who has been admitted to this court pro hac vice, and Mr. Ewing will be presenting the case on behalf of the appellant Gloria Nye.
Morning, welcome to the court.
Good morning, thank you, Your Honor.
Members of the court, may it please the court. I represent Gloria Nye, who is the plaintiff in this case on her own behalf and as executrix of the husband, executrix of the estate of her late husband, John Nye, who served the University of Delaware for 10 years with distinction as Dean of the College of Agriculture. I ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. What happened to the Superior Court in this case is that the court's opinion seems to be based entirely on the complaint as setting forth the facts from the plaintiff's point of view, and it overlooks the central parts of the plaintiff's case. Note that the complaint was obviously drafted before discovery and in substantial reliance on the word of Dr. Nye himself. Due to his demise, his potential evidence is no longer available, and so there are elements of the case that were set forth in the complaint that we find ourselves unable to prove. And on the other hand, discovery turned up evidence of facts that were totally unknown to him and which became part of our case, and all this was set forth in our brief on the motion for summary judgment, but it just looks as if the opinion of the Superior Court was based on the complaint and not on our brief. In describing plaintiff's claim of breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, this is what the Superior Court's opinion says on page 5. First, plaintiff claims that the university breached the covenant of good faith and fair dealing when it allegedly assured Dr. Nye that it wanted him to continue in his position as dean, but then failed to reappoint Dr. Nye to a third term. In addition, the plaintiff asserts that the university failed to provide a written report of the committee's decision. Finally, the plaintiff cites the university's refusal to pay certain compensation, allegedly promised and due to Dr. Nye, as evidence of the university's breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. With respect, that does not describe our case at all. The first item that's mentioned is that the university allegedly assured Dr. Nye it wanted him to continue in his position as dean, but then failed to reappoint him. That was based on a conversation that Dean Nye had and reported to Mrs. Nye that he'd had with the president of the university, President Roselle. President Roselle denies the conversation occurred. Dean Nye not being available, there's obviously no evidence of that. And nowhere in our brief and opposition to summary judgment does it rely on that as a basis for denying summary judgment. That's out of the case. And in fact, it wasn't even part of the good faith claim in the first place. That was part of our claim of promissory estoppel that
due to Dean Nye's reliance on that promise by President Roselle, the plaintiff and her husband had built a new house so that they could entertain in his capacity as dean. But that's out of the case. Second, the opinion says the plaintiff asserts that the university failed to provide a written report of the committee's decision. We do assert that. But that is only a very, very small part of the claim of denial of good faith and fair dealing. Third, the opinion says the plaintiff cites the university's refusal to pay certain compensation allegedly promised and due to Dr. Nye as evidence of the university breach of the covenant. That is not part of our evidence of the breach of the covenant. That is a separate claim for breach of contract, which we maintain and which I'll get to later.
Before we get to implying terms of the agreement, don't we need to know what the actual terms agreed to were, and is there a dispute about that?
The terms of the agreement, the regular agreement with the university, Your Honor, or the terms of the agreement with respect to the severance?
The agreement that you're trying to enforce, the agreement that you say was breached.
Okay. We have two claims. One is a breach of contract by breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that relates to Dean Nye's appointment at the university. And really the provisions of contract that we rely on there are the university's policy with respect to evaluation and performance of deans. There's no dispute about that. That's what their policy is. It's in the appendix.
Excuse me. Is the alleged breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing the sole breach of contract claim?
No.
Is there a breach of the contract, of literal terms of the contract, whatever that might be, is distinguished from implied terms?
Well, certainly with respect to the our major claim, which we couched in terms of breach of the covenant, in light of the what turned up at discovery, we could couch that as a regular breach of contract claim. We think there's a breach of good faith and fair dealing, but there's also a breach of contract there because the university did not follow the procedure set forth in its policy with respect to the way it reviewed Dean Nye's performance and decided not to reappoint him as dean. There's a clear breach of their policy, and that's part of the contract between Dean Nye and the university. So, yes, Justice Jacobs, you're right. That is a separate... that is part of our claim against the university on that.
And that claim is based on what your side contends is a literal term of the contract as opposed to an implied term?
That's correct.
Okay. And what? How do you characterize the good faith and fair dealing claim, which is a breach of an implied term?
The good faith and fair dealing claim is point four of under Pressman, that the employer falsified or manipulated a record to create fictitious grounds to terminate the employee. And the record that was falsified was, in fact, that Dr. Schiavelli told President Roselle, according to President Roselle's testimony, that Dean Nye had resigned. And he told Dean Nye that the decision had been made not to reappoint him, whereas, in fact, neither of those had occurred. What had happened was that Provost Schiavelli, who had no authority to make that decision, had decided apparently not to reappoint Dean Nye, and had frustrated the working out of the process provided in the university's policy.
Well, wasn't your Dean Nye paid the same amount he would have been paid as a dean until the time of his death?
No, because he had gotten, as a dean, every year he got a raise. So he didn't get, that year that he was serving as director of cooperative extension, he didn't get any raise because he was no longer serving as dean. It's a natural inference that he would have gotten a raise if he'd continued to serve as dean during that year.
And were you able to quantify that amount of damages?
Yeah, we did. At one point, I think we had it quantified. I don't remember what exactly it was. It may be somewhere around $6,000. But that's top of my head. I didn't look back at that. Depends. The percentages vary from year to year, but I think that that's basically the average percentage. Now, to go back to the university's policy, what that provides is for when a five-year term as dean is coming to a close, the university must decide whether to reappoint him or not, and then the provost should appoint a committee, which will then investigate his performance as dean, make a recommendation, and submit a report, a written report, which is to be reviewed by the provost with the dean, and then the provost is to make a recommendation, and the president is to make a decision as to whether or not to reappoint the dean. In this case, it's clear that that did not happen. The defendant's interrogatory answers responded to the question of who made the decision not to renew Dean Nye's contract by saying, Dr. Schiavelli made the decision that Dr. Nye should not be reappointed for a third term, and President Roselle concurred in that decision. These answers were verified under oath by the university itself, by Dr. Schiavelli, and by Dr. DiLorenzo, who was chair of the evaluation committee. Nevertheless, both President Roselle and Provost Schiavelli testified differently at their depositions. President Roselle testified he had not concurred in any such decision because he didn't understand that any such decision had to be made. He thought that Dean Nye had resigned. Dr. Schiavelli testified that Dean Nye withdrew his candidacy, so no decision was made. And that's now the university's official position. So the university's position has changed from Schiavelli made the decision to Nye resigned, so no decision had to be made. The problem for them is that the facts refute this position. According to Dr. Schiavelli, the date when Dean Nye told him he was withdrawing was at a meeting between the two on January 4, 2001. Dean Nye made a tape recording of that meeting, which refutes that claim. Moreover, the evidence shows that Provost Schiavelli spoke to two different faculty members of the School of Agriculture even before Christmas of 2000, at least a couple of weeks before the meeting with Dean Nye, and he asked them to take over and serve as interim dean. He asked Dr. Robin Morgan to become interim dean, not just at the end of Dean Nye's term, but for the second semester, before the end of Dean Nye's term. Dean Nye was well aware of these requests, as he had talked about it with Dr. Morgan, and Dr. Schiavelli told him about it at the January 4th meeting and told him that Dr. Morgan was willing to take over. Naturally, Dean Nye said, no, I'm not willing to give up the last semester of my term, even if I'm not going to be reappointed. So,
plainly, again, he was paid for that at the contract rate.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Clearly, the decision not to reappoint him was made before the January 4th meeting, and it wasn't made by President Roselle. Furthermore, and here the Superior Court opinion is correct, it was made without the benefit of the written report. It was made without the benefit of discussing the written report with Dean Nye, and, of course, without the President's decision. Now, Provost Schiavelli's duplicity is further demonstrated by his handling of the committee itself. First, as chair of the committee, he appointed somebody who had never served as a member of an evaluation committee before. He was a brand new dean at the university. He was a brand new member of the University of Delaware, and he'd never even served as dean before. He met weekly, and in some weeks, daily, with Dr. DiLorenzo, the chair of the committee. So he had that influence.
And then, as set forth in our brief, there's a great discrepancy over what happened when Dr. Schiavelli met with the committee. Two members of the committee testified at their depositions that he made statements about suggesting that Dean Nye had somehow been interfering with the work of the committee or spying on it. He expected them to decide against him, which were not supported by anything that those members of the committee had reason to believe had happened. If I can go on now to the administrative leave issue, which is our second breach of contract.
So what is, just so I understand it, what are the damages you seek for the first breach of contract?
The damages would be really the difference between what he was actually paid in the year, most of the year that he served as director of the Cooperative Extension, and the salary he would have received as dean with the normal increment.
The first claim for breach of contract is that the university didn't follow its own policy?
Correct.
With regard to what?
With regard to the decision as to whether or not to reappoint Dean Nye as dean.
When you say policy, you mean the procedure?
The policy for evaluation of the performance of deans. I think it's page A89 in our appendix.
Spell it out for me. What exactly was the university supposed to do under the contract that it didn't do?
In deciding whether or not to reappoint Dean Nye as dean for another term, they were supposed to not only convene an evaluation committee, the committee was supposed to prepare a written report. The provost was supposed to discuss that written report with Dean Nye and make a recommendation to the president of the university, and the president was then to decide whether or not Dean Nye should be reappointed as dean.
And that was short-circuited.
That was short-circuited. And the most important part of that is the president never made a decision.
Is it implicit or explicit that Dean Nye would have had an opportunity to address the report?
Correct. It's explicit in the policy.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
I would like to just mention our point on the administrative leave pay.
Okay.
Which is basically that that the letter from the Superior Court treated the letter from Dr. Schiavelli to Dean Nye as basically that what governed whether or not the administrative leave was a further contract for services or the equivalent of vacation. The letter dated July 11th, which was really a confirmation of the agreement that they had reached on January 4th, orally. That letter nowhere says that any services will be expected from Dean Nye after returning from administrative leave. And they had discussed at the meeting in January 4th that it was up to Dean Nye as to whether to take the dean administrative leave before or after serving as director of the Cooperative Extension. So clearly there wasn't any expectation regarding things that he would do during that year. And
sometimes implies he's gone, right?
Correct. Correct. I'll save the rest of my time if I may. I think I have 2.5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honor, it seems to me there's a little confusion, and let me try to clarify some of what I see or heard at least. First, the claim for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in this case arises out of the university's alleged failure to follow the procedures with respect to the evaluation of deans. Deans at the university are reviewed every 5 years. It is an in-depth annual review. The decision has been made, and the train goes, there is a committee that is appointed. The committee goes out and conducts the review, makes a recommendation to the provost. The provost, in turn, makes a recommendation to the president. The president then decides whether to appoint someone to another 5-year term. That is generally how it goes. What happened in this case was pretty straightforward when you read the record. Dean Nye was having a tough time as Dean of the School of Agriculture. He did not have a lot of faculty support. There was an issue as to whether he was even going to be go up for review, but he would voluntarily resign. Dr. Schiavelli was actually encouraging him not to go forward with the review because he didn't think it would come out well. Nonetheless, in February of 2000, Dean Nye says, let's go ahead and do it. I just want to get it over with. So they convene the review committee. The review committee over the summer of 2000 into the fall of 2000 does its work. And ultimately, on December 4th, 2000, thereabouts, votes not to recommend for his reappointment. And indeed, something during that review unprecedented happened. The president of the college university received a petition from one faculty member less, one tenured faculty member less, other faculty in the College of Agriculture, saying that Dean Nye should not be reappointed. Now, Provost Schiavelli in December of 2000 gets the word that the committee has voted no. The committee is advisory to him. So what does the provost do to a distinguished dean who has served 10 years? He calls him and says, Dean Nye, they voted no. You know how I feel about it. It's no. What do you want to do about this? Why don't you think about it? In the course of between that conversation and January 4th, 2001, the conversation which Dean Nye surreptitiously tape recorded, which raises an issue as to admissibility and the like. I don't think that the evidence of Dean Nye's statements in that tape are admissible. But nonetheless, what happens in that intervening time is Provost Schiavelli does what the provost of the university does. He starts to think, who's going to be my next dean? What am I going to do? I've got to do a search. Search takes years. So he calls people who he thinks might be able to serve as interim deans. He calls Don Sparks, Professor Sparks, to see if he'd be interested. He's not interested because he might want to be a candidate. He calls Dr. Robin Morgan. Would you be interested? These are the conversations that the Dean Nye now contends are some invidious motive and intent in creating the fraud and ill will because we weren't complying with the policy. And what happens is these conversations, and Provost Schiavelli has a plan. And he meets with Dean Nye on January 4th of 2001 and says, what do you want to do? How do you want to handle this? Because the fact of the matter is, if the report was issued, it would be public. It wouldn't be nice. And if you're looking at trying to get out of there and get another job, which Dean Nye have been doing, which Provost Schiavelli has been helping him to do, you don't want that public record. And that's what happens in that conversation. They come up with a plan to quietly exit out of this. That quiet plan to exit results in no report being issued. Provost Schiavelli had asked the committee to hold off writing the report until he had an opportunity to talk to Dean Nye about it. He then, once there's no committee, he said, what are we going to do with your job? Provost Schiavelli initially wanted him out right away as dean, but they agreed that no, he'll serve out the remainder of the term. Dr. Morton will then be the interim dean for a year, during which period of time, Dean Nye would step down from the deanship to the director of cooperative extension for a year. He would then have 1 year of administered leave. He would then return to the faculty.
This is now, of that recital of facts, what portion, if any, is disputed?
Yeah, I don't think any of it is disputed. And the problem is that the plaintiffs in this case have the fundamental problem that Dean Nye is dead. So they don't have someone to come in and tell his story. And thus, the university's admissible evidence, Dr. Schiavelli's testimony, the president's, Dr. DiLorenzo's, is essentially uncontroverted on these points. And that You know, the genuine issue of fact that is being created here is not admissible evidence against admissible evidence. It is, ooh, there's a credibility determination here, maybe. You know, one witness says Provost Schiavelli said this to the committee, another one says it said that to the committee. But the fact of the matter is that none of those disputes, most of which you will see lined out in the appellant's brief, aren't material.
Well, why can't it be inferred that administrative leave and the payment of a 4-year salary for administrative leave meant leave, go away, and this is part of the severance package or part of the quiet plan to exit, part of the overall package which is due and should be paid?
Could it be inferred in the case that that is the case? Yes. Is it in this case or could it be in this case? No. And here's why.
Well, doesn't your answer that you just gave me require a trial?
No, Your Honor, because what happened in this case is the university came forth with evidence through the testimony of its witnesses and the affidavit of the Vice President of Administration, Maxine Cohn, and laid out exactly what administrative leave means for Dean.
Even that testimony was at war with itself, though, wasn't it?
No, I'm glad you raised that, Your Honor, because there is a point that when somebody says some of the testimony is not analogous, that Dr. Cohn's testimony, she had first testified in her deposition that it was a situation that she was describing in which a faculty member had died with a similar benefit and the university did not pay that person. Her testimony says that's not analogous. She says she's talking about the situation, says, although it's not analogous. A page and a half later, in that same transcript, and it's in the record, she says it is analogous. So, I mean, the testimony, whether the Vice President for Administration is saying a particular event is analogous or is not, I think is separate apart from the legal meaning of the testimony. And here, the evidence is that deans who received administrative leave at the university have only received it assuming they performed.
Yeah, but isn't the issue what the agreement was here, not what other deans got? I mean, that might be relevant, but...
But the giving of administrative leave to a dean, a former dean, is a practice at the university. And the practice has been done with every dean that served out a full term and that didn't go elsewhere. So they go on their leave, they get paid a salary while they're on the leave, they're expected to retool and get themselves ready to go back to the classroom. They've been out of the classroom for 5 years, now they're going to teach.
But that scenario,
right,
is at odds with the scenario that you portrayed for us earlier in your presentation, under which the provost and Dean Mai were arranging to short-circuit the normal procedural process so that Mai could go on and look for a job elsewhere. I mean, there's a distinct fact as to whether Mai was going to return to the faculty and whether Schiavelli didn't know that.
There are two separate issues, Your Honor. One, the policy and the procedure that they're trying to short-circuit and make nice about is what do we do with the dean's appointment? The second issue, the letter, is what do we do about your return to the faculty? They're two separate issues. And the normal procedure would be, upon stepping down as dean, that you get the year of administrative leave and then you return to the faculty. Many deans have done it. Was Dr. Dean Mai free to go out and find another job? Certainly. And had he wouldn't have been paid his administrative leave. There's nothing in this
grant. There's no personal service component to the administrative leave.
Well, certainly there is a personal service component because it's the university's expectation that you as a faculty, you as an administrator returning to faculty, are going to be doing something to retool yourself to get ready for the classroom. You might have to learn, go back and learn your whole subject matter again. You might have to, you know, take courses for how to teach again. Whatever it may be.
Could he have taken a trip around the world?
Could he have taken a trip around the world? Assuming that it met with the plan of the provost to retool yourself? Probably, yes. There's no great restriction on a faculty member during that time. But it's clear that there's an expectation that you do something. And then at the end that you return to the faculty. And the evidence as to the university's policy and practice is uncontroverted. There's nobody that's come in and said.
Isn't there a dispute as to whether the university was planning to make an exception to its repeatedly uncontroverted policy in the case of Dr. Nye?
There is no dispute because...
Either they expected him to return to the faculty or not. And the deal here was that there would be no report and nothing on the record that would interfere with Dr. Nye's ongoing effort to get a job elsewhere, doesn't that create a dispute of facts as to whether in his particular case there was really an expectation that he would be returning to the faculty?
But there's no admissible evidence supporting what you've just said. There's nothing in the record that supports that.
Well, you represented it to us.
Well, you're not. I don't think that's what I was representing. If I did, I misspoke. The expectation for Dr. Nye was that he was an employee of the University of Delaware. He was taking his leave and coming back.
I think you said, and I wrote it down, that the provost and Dr. Nye agreed on a plan not to issue a report because of its potential adverse impact on Dr. Nye's job search.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, I think this is two ships passing in the night, and I apologize, that yes, during the search, D. Nye was looking for other employment. The provost had given him recommendations. It was well known that he was looking for other jobs. He hadn't been successful. If he had not been successful 2 years out or 3 years out, he'd still be at the university. I mean, well, granted, he may go and get another job. I don't think
that may be your jury argument. But don't those conflicting inferences at least create an issue for the jury to decide?
But, Your Honor, the problem I have is that there is no one to testify to give the inference for Mr. or Dean Nye.
Well, you have two people to testify. You have Maxine Combs, who's saying, telling us what the university's policy is and expectation, and Dr. Schiavelli's testimony what was being done here was to circumvent the normal process in order to not to prejudice Dr. Nye's effort to get a job elsewhere, whether it had been successful or not.
But the leave policies and the like were not a circumvention of anything. Those were things that were just the normal emoluments of stepping down in the dean. And so Provost Schiavelli's...
You're making an argument that we've got to accept these facts as undisputed and uphold the ruling as a matter of law. And I'm posing to you what looks like a conflict of fact, or at least of inferences. Either it is or it isn't. If it isn't, tell me why.
But what I see is Dr. Schiavelli saying, here, I've given him a year of administrative leave. This is what it meant to me. I expect him to retool himself in personal services contract work for the university. That's what he says. Dr. Cohen says that's what the university's policy is.
When would he get paid for the administrative leave? Is it monthly as it goes on?
Normal, ordinary salary.
So what would happen if at the end of that year of administrative leave, he in fact did not return to the faculty of the University of Delaware?
He would have kept the money that he had, and he would have gone and done whatever he did.
So he would not have breached any agreement with the university?
No, he would not have breached any agreement with the university. Similarly, had he gone off, and I think the opponents make this point, had he gone off and got another job, the university would have demanded the money back.
So there was no mutual expectation that he returned to the faculty?
Yes, there was. I mean, there is an expectation that he returns to the faculty, but at the same time, he's not an indentured servant. I mean, he can go get another job if he wants to. It was not a quid pro quo. We're giving you the administrative leave, and you must return to the faculty. It is the normal course of an employee's history when you're a dean coming back to faculty.
Well, I understand the university was attempting to be nice to Dr. Nye and have a transition, but isn't the administrative leave just another nice way of getting severance pay?
No, it is not severance pay because virtually every dean that has received it, in fact, returns to the faculty. It's the ordinary course. And the period of time is designed to allow you to retool yourself and get ready to come back to the classroom. There's no difference in a sabbatical in some sense.
There was a suggestion in your opponent's argument that there's an inconsistency between affidavits that were submitted, either in support of summary judgment or perhaps filed along with the answer. and the deposition testimony of two prominent figures at the University of Delaware in this dispute. Is there any truth to that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And indeed, I think if you read the transcripts, President Roselle never testified that Provost Schiavelli told him that Dean Nye resigned. What he testified was, Provost Schiavelli told me that the committee voted no. And then I never heard anything more about it. And therefore, I just assumed that it had worked out along the terms that they had understood that it would get worked out. I mean, that's how things happen. So this issue of the interrogatory answers, saying Provost Schiavelli made a decision not to reappoint, and President Roselle concurred, when you read the transcript as a whole, you'll see that's exactly what happened. And I think what's telling here on this point is this meeting occurred, and certainly in advance of January 4th, 2001, Dean Nye knew he was not going to be reappointed. He knew the report wasn't being issued, and he knew that President Roselle hadn't come to him and said anything. He worked at the university for a year and 4 months before he died. Not once during that time did he say, "Where's the report?" Not once did he say, "President Roselle, will you rule on my reappointment?" He met with President Roselle many times. Indeed, the appellants mentioned the fact that he had met with President Roselle earlier about his reappointment.
Never once. Given all of that, I understand that supports your argument that there was a quiet plan to exit, which was namely a settlement of an employment dispute, right?
It's a quiet plan to exit a deanship as opposed to an employment relationship. Faculty members who become deans are part of the administration. You lose your, you have your faculty appointment, but you're not on the faculty. Administrators like deans who lose their deanships return to the faculty. You're still a faculty member. You're no longer a member of the administration.
There's two different jobs at stake here. The implied covenant claim deals with the deanship. The breach of contract claim deals with the employment relationship, the faculty relationship. And I don't have much time, and I want to just run through very quickly, maybe in bullet point fashion here, on the breach of the implied covenant claim. There's simply, and the Superior Court got this right, there's simply no evidence in the record of the requisite degree of fraud, ill will, deceit. Nobody was manipulating Dean Nye's record to get the committee to vote no. I also want to say that this case is very analogous in this regard to another case against the University of Delaware that was decided by the Federal District Court, University of Delaware, it was Geddes versus University of Delaware, where Judge McKelvey expressly ruled that the violation of a policy without more is not sufficient to give rise to a claim under the implied covenant. And I actually think, in light of the way this case comes down, that there's a public policy issue here on the implied covenant claim. Dean Nye wasn't fired. He wasn't terminated. He received he didn't receive a pay cut of any sort. He kept all his benefits. The implied covenant claim historically has been extremely narrow. Generally, I think there's 160 reported decisions in the Delaware court under the implied covenant claim. Almost always applied to the termination concept. To recognize that cause of action here, where you're not terminating an employee, opens up this window to employees coming in and claiming breach of the implied covenant on virtually any employment-related dispute, whether it be a denial of promotion, whether it be a bad performance review, a bad raise. I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed in the sense of a recognition of the claim in this context where the employee wasn't terminated raises a specter that I think needs to be considered. In sum, I didn't get to address all my points, but the Superior Court properly entered summary judgment in this case. Despite ample opportunity for discovery, appellants weren't able to produce sufficient admissible evidence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. I asked President Roselle at his deposition
I said, are you aware that there wasn't any report in this case? And this is A227 and following of the of our appendix. And he said he's aware. Why not? Let's see. My recollection is that Dean Nye wants to know what with you going to be voted, the nature of the report to be voted, decided that he should resign. I believe that's the situation, and so the committee report didn't was not promulgated. What did you base that understanding on? My recollection. Did you have a communication with Dean Nye about it? No. Did you have any communication with Dean Nye after the committee had voted? I don't recall any. So that year and a half after the committee voted, that Dean Nye was still working at the university, and he suggested there could have been all sorts of meetings between them. According to the president, he cut him off. There was no further communication with Dean Nye after that committee vote.
And your contention that Geddes versus University of Delaware was wrongly decided?
Oh, no, of course not. My contention is that there is here, unlike there, evidence of misrepresentations. That Dr. Schiavelli met every day with President Rozelle. That's the testimony. Now, the idea that he would have gotten the understanding that Dean Nye had decided to resign from anyone other than Dr. Schiavelli is just preposterous. I mean, where else would he get it? And that they didn't talk about it? He was a dean. It was being non-renewed. They had no discussion about it.
Do you agree with this phrase that they developed a quiet plan to exit?
I don't agree with that at all, frankly. And in some ways, it would be to my benefit to agree with it because it fits in with the administrative leave. But Dean Nye, at that meeting, Dr. Schiavelli said, let's announce that you've decided to step down. And he said, no, I'm not going to announce that. Let's be straight out. Let's tell it straight out. I've already told my staff that the university decided not to renew my contract with Dean.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.